All right, so welcome. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm here in the studio over the weekend with Jack Archer. They've been on the show before, but it's been a while.
Quite a while. Hello.
Quite a while. Yes, welcome back. We are recording on President's Day. Maybe you have the day off. We're not going to talk about President's Day.
No.
It's just incidental. So obviously it's February. We're halfway through February. I haven't really done a Black History Month show. If people have listened to the show for a long time, I usually end up talking about this, that like these months are insufficient. So it's like I don't only talk about women during March, and I don't only talk about Black people and their activism during February. But it's also a good thing. I don't know. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about having a month?
So I think... I remember reading on the history of it, there were people like, oh, just the very existence is bad. Like, no, it was a step forward when Black History Month first became a regular, a yearly affair. It used to originally be a week, and then it eventually became a month. And it was something that was pushed for by HBCUs, if I'm not mistaken, basically trying to bring emphasis to a part of history that isn't really taught, to be frank. I think, honestly, the biggest problem with Black History Month right now isn't so much that it's siloed or that it's the shortest month of the year. but I think the biggest problem is that it, instead of being an opportunity to genuinely dig into the history of Black Americans in this country, stretching from, you know, their hardships to, or our hardships to our victories, to our contributions, it just becomes this sort of regurgitated like fact sheet about the same two or three Black heroes, you know, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, you know, and it just becomes this month where we go, hey, remember that slavery was a thing? That was bad. And then came King, and then he was shot, and magically that somehow made everything better. Mm-hmm. And that's frustrating. I actually remember a conversation I had. This conversation stuck in my mind. It was, I'm going to say maybe as much as 10 years ago now. I was hanging out with a group of friends, and this one guy named John, he has a generic name, so I don't think I need to change it. I've got like six John friends.
He knows who he is.
He knows who he is, and that's probably a good thing. And we were hanging out at a friend's house, and I was arguing that there isn't enough history about women taught in our schools, or about Black people, or about queer people. And he literally said, well, maybe there isn't a lot of history because they haven't really done anything. And I realized he wasn't saying this out of some sort of, you know, deep-seated hostility towards women or Black folks or queer folks. He was saying this because he genuinely believed that if things happened, he would know about it. Mm-hmm. He didn't understand that one of the legacies of systemic oppression is a long-term, is the erasure of the histories and contributions of the people who are being oppressed. He literally didn't realize that that phrase, history is written by the victors, includes, I guess, those not just military victories, but the social victories in the form of dominance and the ability to suppress everything that doesn't fit into your view of society and, mm-hmm. and your ideals for the world.
Well, yeah. And what you were talking about with, you know, Black history being a really bad thing happened, and then two or three really brave people
fixed it.
Well, yeah. But also, I think that becomes a problem because they become these like mythical people instead of some of the many, many, many thousands of everyday people who struggled in different ways and who, you know, founded historically Black colleges and universities, like you were saying, who like did scientific research, mm-hmm. who just like kept their families safe, mm-hmm. who marched, who did, you know, mm-hmm. When you just focus on the same four people all of the time, it's easy for John, who we'll pick on for now, to believe that like those four people transcended and everyone else was just
not good enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it definitely sends a secondary message of, if you want oppression to end, then you just need to be like Dr. King. You know, you just need to be like Rosa Parks. You just need to stand up for yourself and the world will get better. It also, to sort of reflect on what a completely different friend said, I don't know, we'll call him Terrence for now. This friend told me that the view that we have of how to fight racism and whatnot, that we just need to like stand up and tell people how we feel and it'll get better, is really a huge disservice to white people, because it assumes that somehow the white population is so devoid of empathy that they literally have to be told, hey, discrimination sucks. Mm-hmm. Hey, oppression sucks. You know, that it's literally a matter of just complete ignorance as to how people feel. When in reality, we need to actually admit that a lot of what we're experiencing, a lot of the things that uphold systemic oppression, is a combination of genuine ignorance, not of how people feel, mm-hmm. but of the systems themselves, and of actually just having bad views.
Mm-hmm. And resistance and fear to losing what we have, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I was just having that conversation this morning. A friend of mine who's a person of color texted me, and he said that feeling when a white guy tells you you'd catch more flies with honey than vinegar, basically talking about racial oppression. And I was like, did you tell him that racism isn't an issue of hearts and minds at all? And we're having that conversation right now. So mm-hmm. So you've been sharing some of these things, right? And I've seen a few different people this year, kind of in the social media world that I'm in. I've seen quite a few different like black educators and activists both posting educational things about Black History Month, but also saying like, learning's important, but like, find out what you can do, like mm-hmm. make some reparations in some way, whether it's like financial or mm-hmm. like figuring out like, where do you fit in these communities and contributing. So it's been an interesting conversation. I think the shift is like slowly happening in the circles that we're in.
In the circles that we're in, definitely. Yeah. Although I would say sometimes the hardest battles are within the circles that we are already in. So since you mentioned that I'm like chairing, the word you use, chairing stuff, it's a funny thing. I don't think I'm actually chairing anything. I'm definitely just sitting in a position of relative authority in several organizations. Yeah. And I'm going to take maybe the opportunity to do a bit of a shout out to some of those. So one of the areas where I think we struggle, particularly in the Northwest, you know, I was born and raised here. I've lived here my whole life. And one of the things that I've struggled with as a black person here is the covert racism that is very prevalent here, that is harder to pinpoint and thus harder to convince people exists. And the resistance to change, because to admit that you need to change is to admit that you were wrong in the first place, is to admit that racism isn't this thing, this on the outside of you, this bad monster, boogeyman, whatever, but actually this this social force that permeates our whole lives, and a set of norms and thoughts that actually live inside you, whether you mean to be malicious or not. Especially among people who really, really want to be, you know, they want to be the woke friend, they want to be progressive, they want to be, you know, the good revolutionary or whatever, those can be sometimes the most difficult spaces to find and continue pushing for equality and dignity in the way that those organizations run. And actually, for that very reason, I'm gonna bring up. Can I bring up the Pajals Conference? Is that a thing I can bring
up? Sure, yeah, please.
So the Pajals Conference is happening February 22 and February 23. It launches on February 22 at 6 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Spokane. And then the next day continues from 8:30 a.m. till, I think, 5:30 p.m. It's a fantastic conference. I've gone absolutely every single year that I can since I've moved to the Spokane area. And this year, I am super privileged to get to do a workshop for it. About intersectionality in movement spaces. Because one of the things that I've noticed is, because of the way we talk about racism as an issue of hearts and minds, like as an issue of malice, is that not only does it make it harder to address in places where everyone wants to think of themselves as like an empathetic person, but it also means that a lot of spaces assume that they have no issues to deal with, including and probably especially progressive movement spaces. I've seen that a lot here. I don't spend a ton of time in spaces where I would be overtly unwelcome. But in the spaces where I'm surrounded by people who are ostensibly friends, I've dealt with a fair amount of, I would say, ignorance and oppressive behavior. And so I'm doing this workshop, and I'm very thankful to the team at Pajaz for choosing my workshop to sort of share some of those experiences and help people who really want to learn how to be more inclusive in material ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I guess I can promote it now. I just realized, since I'm no longer like formally in, I've never been able to talk about Pajaz on the show because I've had an official role, but I don't have an official role now. So I can tell you that you can register for that conference at pjals.org, PJALS.org, or peacejustice.org, and go to Jack's workshop and other workshops. You can register late. You can register right now. So
yeah.
What do you think? I mean, not to like blow the workshop, but I'm just curious, when you say immaterial ways, you know, I think everybody wants, it's like you were saying, everybody wants to like do the right thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes don't know, like, what does that actually look like? Like, what does it look like for a space, an activism space, to feel both welcoming and unwelcoming to you in a way that like white people might not think about?
So let me talk about this from two angles. I'll talk about it from my angle, feeling welcome or unwelcome. But then I also, in the interest of acknowledging that just because I'm a Black person and a queer person doesn't mean that I haven't screwed up on this front, I'll talk about the other side of it, being on the side of not being as welcoming as I could be. The first one, I'll blow a little bit of the workshop because heaven knows I want to test material. and the first one I'll talk about is I had this experience of being involved with a march here in Spokane. Actually, I'm just gonna name it because everybody comes out looking pretty good by the end of the story. So I'm gonna trust all the organizers of March for Science to forgive me for putting you on blast for a second. But you all are wonderful organizers, and thank you for what you do, March for Science Spokane. But when I first got involved with March for Science Spokane, and I was only involved really the first year that it happened, I wasn't invited. I wasn't actually even supposed to be there. They were having a meeting at, I believe it was Rocket Bakery, and I came in to grab some coffee and lunch or whatever. I don't even remember what I was up to that I was in that part of town that I was at that particular Rocket, but there I was. And I hear them talking about, you know, science and, you know, how it's being eroded and, like, what it, people don't even trust facts anymore, and and trying to plan this thing and how it's all part of this greater effort to promote logic and promote a better world, you know, and protecting our planet, et cetera, et cetera. And me being who I am, I think I recognized all of maybe one person at the table and was like, hey, how's it going?
Like, yeah, I can see that. You're like, this seems like people I want to meet.
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, oh, wait, no, it wasn't even the Rocket. By the way, I should ask, can I just like mention random businesses?
Sure, yeah. Cool? Yeah. All right. You can say whatever you want. It's me who has the issue. So you can do whatever you want.
So I think it was Iron Horse. I think, anyway, it was, I think it was at a bar, actually, because the memory is shifting in my head. So I remember what table we were sitting at and all that. It's like a little video in my brain. And I just sort of scooted in next to them and was like, hey, y'all, how's it going? let's talk. And then, because I don't know, I just have an overblown sense of confidence in my ability to just say something that matters in the moment. I just sort of joined and started asking questions and hung out. And they said, hey, you know, you seem pretty cool. This is our next meeting if you want to join us. And I was like, sweet. So I joined them, and over the next couple of days, eventually they were planning speakers for the March for Science. And I was looking at the speaker list, and I was looking at the issues they were addressing, and there was a distinct lack of color on that list. And I've long had my own frustrations with environmental movements for many reasons, and a lot of those old frustrations sort of bubbled up in this moment where I went, where are all the people of color? You know, like, where are the Black people, the Native people, the Latinx people, the Asian people, you know, where's everybody else in this march? You know, is this march for everyone? And they're like, oh, well, you know, we wanted all of our speakers to be scientists. I'm like, okay, that's great. Where are the black scientists? Where are the Latinx scientists? Where are the Asian scientists, etc.? Like, oh, well, I mean, we just, you know, we don't really know they're, we don't know where they are. They're not really around. They're not really, you know, many out there. And I went, oh, okay. Like, have you, who have you reached out to so far? Like, how have you tried to access the scientific communities of color? And like, oh, I mean, we haven't actually tried anything yet. Like, we just don't know where to go. We kind of don't see them, so we just kind of assume there aren't. And what it boiled down to at the end of this was that this group of planners, because they didn't see scientists of color around, assumed that they weren't there. And furthermore, assumed that if they were there, that they would somehow just magically make their way into their cohort, you know? And I remember sitting there and looking around the table and going, you guys, inclusion is intentional. And they're like, well, I mean, you know, you're here. And I went, no. You guys never invited me. I mean, you invited me after I randomly stumbled upon your group, showed up and inserted myself into the situation. Mm-hmm. You welcomed me. And for that, I'm grateful, but you didn't invite me. You don't get to take credit for my presence here. Mm-hmm. And my presence here is completely insufficient. I'm one person. I'm not a scientist. And I can't be expected to be the voice for all people of color in Spokane. To their immense credit, they took my criticism very well and they ran with it. And they actually went out of their way to try and brainstorm ways to find people of color to be involved in this process. And they actually, to my surprise, while there was a lot of vibrant discussion around all this, there wasn't a ton of defensiveness or anger or frustration from them. There was confusion. There was curiosity. There were moments of misunderstanding. But I actually felt like I was in a group of people who were more concerned with living their values than being right. Mm-hmm. So they definitely won my respect for that. To me, what I guess like the lesson I would pull out of that to tell other people is that inclusion is intentional. You know, people of color, black people in particular, are not just going to show up because you exist.
What? Yeah.
And furthermore, the scientists in that group who are saying, oh, well, you know, I don't see very many black people in our science associations, in our whatever. I mean, they come to our conferences sometimes, but I don't think there are any in Spokane. And I remember asking, why would they identify with a science group that fits their, you know, profession if that profession isn't already welcoming to them? I can't speak for black scientists. I don't actually know this for certain, but my suspicion is that a lot of those people identify more with being black than being a scientist. So if they're going to put effort into joining an association, they're more likely to join their local, you know, black affinity group, whatever it may be, than they are to join a professional association where they may or may not feel welcome. Mm-hmm. And if you want black people, you have to go into those spaces. You have to find those spaces where they feel comfortable. And respectfully, mm-hmm. talk to those people and say, hey, would you be willing to lend your voice to this process? Mm-hmm. Can we get your expertise?
Or also, you know, what do you think about this process? Like, how do you think we should do this? Not just like, hey, we're doing a thing and we'd sure like if there were some people of color doing the thing that we already want to do the way we already want to do it. Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that's the kind of next hurdle after that from my perspective. But it's funny. It's exactly what you were saying at the beginning when we first started talking. And your friend said, maybe there just isn't this history, right?
Yeah.
When John was like, oh, well, Black History Month, I don't know, maybe just
they didn't do that
people
much.
Haven't done that much. It's the exact same thing of like, oh, well, I don't immediately know them, so I guess there aren't these scientists, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah, it's the exact same thing. So, yeah, that's a good example. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jack Archer. We're talking about all kinds of stuff, but we're kind of doing a Black History Month show. We're doing a not President's Day, President's Day show here in the studio. So, yeah. So you've also been putting out, you're one of the people who have been putting out things you should know on some of the days this month. I guess, have you learned anything new this year that you didn't know about Black history?
Yes, actually. I'm talking too loud.
No, you're good.
I actually ran across this post about George Washington Carver, which, okay, you hear that name, what's the first thing you think of?
Peanut butter.
Boom, peanut butter.
First grade, right? Peanut butter, yes.
He didn't invent peanut butter. Like, literally, George Washington Carver did not invent peanut butter, which I'm, like, slightly embarrassed to say, at the age of, like, 27, I definitely thought was a thing. Mm-hmm. Because that was what I was taught, literally, in elementary school by teachers who were supposed to be purveyors of truth. And what it turns out is that while he did come up with a lot of different ways to use peanuts and help, like, stimulate the market, as a crop, the reason why peanuts were so important was because they actually restored the soil after it had been leached of all of its, I think it's nitrogen, after extensive cotton planting and the planting of other crops. It just leached all that out of the soil. The South, which was primarily an agricultural economy during George Washington Carver's time, was starting to see a bit of a collapse because the soil was dying because they planted the same things in the same areas over and over again. And what George Washington Carver actually did was save an entire agricultural economy, which is so much bigger than inventing something you spread on bread in the morning.
Yeah, that's wild. I didn't know that either. So he was a pioneer of soil remediation and not the inventor of peanut butter.
Yeah. Now, I think he helped popularize it.
I mean, there were probably a lot of peanuts lying around while they were doing the research. So
right. And, you know, there was a great process in order to get Southern planters to plant peanuts to renew their soil. They had to have a market for them. So there was this, you know, ongoing conversation of which he was a part of about, well, what can we make out of this? How can we make this useful? How can we make this profitable so that we can renew our soil and, you know, continue making a life out of from the land? And but it turns out that peanut butter, I guess, had actually been invented by, and this is where I might be misremembering, but I want to say it was originally like an Asian invention. It was a different people group altogether in a different part of the world that invented peanut butter and had been using it as a type of food, you know, putting it on stuff long before George Washington Carver. And he was just like, hey, they're doing it. We can do that, right?
Yeah.
That's also another thing worth, to circle back a little bit, I said earlier I would give an example of a time when I'd been kind of on the wrong side of inclusion before. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've seen myself called out for in my own community, where it's not just a, you know, in the case of this history of George Washington Carver, where the invention of peanut butter actually belongs to a different set of people of color, but is now just ours now, I guess, because that's what people are being taught, because, you know, history gets flattened out in that way. You know, one thing that I've been called out for before by people who I'm very grateful for is eliminating the complexities of blackness that I don't personally experience. So being, you know, native and black, which is more common, especially in the Pacific Northwest, than it might be, I don't know, in other areas, or at least I've personally met a fair number of people who are native and black and who embrace both of those things about themselves and see that erased. Or people who have physical disabilities and are black. You know, I'm a relatively, like, able-bodied person. And I remember someone telling me, actually another queer black person, who I was, we were having a conversation about clothes and about perceptions around clothes and whatnot, because like me, they're gender fluid. And although they have more, I guess, feminist as a part of their identity than I do, I'm more mask of center. And they talked about, they wear a lot of leggings. And I asked a question about, well, you know, how do you reconcile, you know, your masculine feelings with leggings, you know, like how do those two things go together? I have a hard time seeing it. And we had a good enough relationship that they were able to, like, take this question in good faith and not be upset with me over it. But they were like, look, I'm not an able-bodied person. Leggings provide range of motion, and they don't constrict anything, and they are comfortable, and they are easy to wear and take on and take off in a way that a lot of other pants simply are not, especially if you're not able-bodied. And that doesn't diminish my masculinity to wear these clothes. Like, I, like, this is an area where my physical disabilities intersect with, you know, my gender and also, you know, my race on top mm-hmm. of that. And it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is me not seeing the things beyond my own nose.
Mm-hmm. I'm nodding so big because it took experiencing chronic illness and, like, debilitating body effects thereof for me to truly appreciate leggings. So I hear your friend, and I nod a big nod for leggings. Yeah, that's true. I think, what do you think about that? And I think it's possible that, I know we've talked about this in real life before, so I'm confused if we've talked about it on the radio before, but I mean, as you're well aware, there's all this hubbub in certain circles around, I'm trying to think of a way to say it without saying the annoying talking points I don't like, but you know, what gets referred to as, like, PC culture or,
oh,
like,
God.
Things like that taking over. So where do you think, where I think there is a point in there
mm-hmm.
is people playing the, you know, more woke than thou game
mm-hmm.
and putting each other down mm-hmm. for not having a perfect political consciousness. I think that mm-hmm. that is a problem on the left.
Absolutely.
Sometimes. But where do you think that balance is? Like, how do you think we can address that and be forgiving toward each other? Like, you had this relationship with this person.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they could say that to
yeah.
you. I don't know. What's your take on that?
That's hard. I guess the first thing I want to say is that it is possible to both acknowledge that it is important to respect people who have not traditionally been respected by our society, which is really what people are usually talking about when they talk about PC culture, is respecting people who have not previously had the voice to demand respect and suddenly feeling disoriented by that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do that. It's possible to acknowledge that we need to do that and acknowledge that none of us were as aware yesterday as we are today, to put it really broadly, right? That everyone is going to be in a different phase of learning, and people deserve freedom to learn and space to be wrong sometimes. Freedom to learn does not mean freedom from accountability. I think too often, like, my frustration with the whole PC culture debate is it's like, oh, either on one side, it's like, either you respect people or you don't. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, it might not be. I mean, like, on the face of it, it is. But first, you have to assume that we all have the same understanding of respect, you know? And what characteristics of people are, I guess, like, intrinsic and essential to their being
mm-hmm.
and which ones aren't. Like, we have to get on the same page about that. We don't actually have a universal understanding of what it means to, quote, respect people, because we are still integrating so many different kinds of people into the very definition of people, frankly. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah.
On the other hand, there's that whole, you know, PC culture is ruining everything and people are just getting offended. It's like, well, yeah, people are getting offended, but they were always offended.
Exactly.
Now they have the freedom to say it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the argument that I keep hearing about how, oh, there was a time when you remember that with the whole blackface situation in Virginia, when people were like, oh, you know, there was a time when it didn't mean that, like, when it was just fine. It's like, no, there was never a time when blackface was okay. There was a time when the dominant culture engaged in blackface and wouldn't be met with any opposition because the people they were parodying did not have the political or social power
mm-hmm.
to object to the treatment they were receiving. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't gag someone and tell them they're silent.
Yeah.
That's not how that works.
Yeah. Well, and there was also a time when the white people, you know, everyone in our generation's grandparents mm-hmm. who are white, being exposed to blackface probably on some level.
Mm-hmm.
I heard an interview that there's a woman who's writing a book right now about the history of blackface that sounds fascinating. And, like, mm-hmm. I didn't realize what a mainstream part of, like, white
oh, yeah.
culture it is
oh,
because
yeah.
I'm just young enough to not be exposed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that now the other issue is that there's, you know, grandkids of these people who have enough proximity to people of color because mm-hmm. we're more integrated as a generation than any of the generations mm-hmm. before us generally, that, and we have more access to information, that, like, that's the other disorienting factor, is like, oh no, our white children are rebelling against us in some number and, like, agreeing with the people who are offended, and now they're offended. Yeah, it's a strange.
Well, I mean, you said grandparents, but you don't even have to go all the way back to grandparents. You can just go to grandparents. I'm going to sort of mention this movie that I hate giving it press, but I think it's worth mentioning. Soul Man. It's a movie that came out in 1986, the premise of which was a white guy put on blackface to go to college so he could get scholarships. And it was popular.
Mm-hmm.
This came out in 1986. My sisters were born in 1986. Like my family, my natal family was almost completely formed in 1986. That was only a few years before I was born. And that's, you know, the vast majority of my friends were born before that date, honestly. So I don't even think we have to go particularly far back to get to a time when blackface can be literally a blockbuster joke.
Mm-hmm.
And no one thinks twice about it.
Yeah. Well, and in the Virginia situation, I mean, that yearbook looks like my parents' yearbooks. So,
yeah.
Grandparents was a stretch, for sure. Yeah. So, I don't know. Where do you think... Obviously, I think we're at the, crunch point. I feel like there's a physics metaphor that I'm, almost smart enough to make, but
singularity,
not quite.
I don't know.
Well, I think things are all... We're, in... the crunch right now, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to come out on the other side at some point with a new understanding. I don't know. What's your... I'm going to dovetail this into something else. I was just reading about, and I've been following, the Movement for Black Lives. Mm-hmm. Organizers have, the last 2 years, possibly 3 years, I think starting in 2016, Black Futures Month. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I'm not.
But they
really want to Google now.
They're recognizing Black Futures Month, and it's all focused on Afrofuturism and art and cultural production, because they're yes, Black history is important, but
where are we going?
People always want to focus on the dark. It's a dark history in this country. And, there's amazing moments in it, and there's amazing people, but it's, primarily been a history of transcending terrible things that have been done. So they're working to focus on but where are we going now?
Yeah.
So I guess with that in mind, where are we going now?
Well, let me pull out my crystal ball.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. I know where I want to be going. It's funny, I always have a hard time commenting on the community, as it were, in part because I can't say that I've ever grown up with a particularly large Black community. I don't feel like I have that same innate finger on the pulse of whatever that some people seem to have when they speak with authority about, how we're doing or where we're going. I do feel like here in Spokane, my friends and, comrades and co-conspirators are making great progress in pushing our system forward from various sides. The friends of mine who are engaged in forms of activism that are a bit more, shall we say, street level, and maybe even more covert, to the friends of mine, and I guess would include myself in this, who are working within, in many cases, the various systems that frustrate us, to alter them and change them and force them to update and live up to their stated ideals, regardless of, in many ways, in spite of the history. You say you're about justice for all. Let's talk about that all. I feel like when it comes to where Black people are going in general, I don't know, but I see a lot of awesome things happening around this place. I friends who are artists, who I'm going to give some shout outs and potentially embarrass some people for a second. We've got local artists like Chantel Jackson, who produces some lovely and truly intriguing art, which to me, if art is intriguing, that's the best thing it can be. We have people like Diva Logan, who's working on her Shades of Me project. We have, continuing work of people like Sandy Williams, who's still producing the only truly Black newspaper in the Pacific Northwest, and has paired it with you know, a Black Business Expo that we have coming up on the 23rd, I want to say. And you should look that up. And also, you know, putting out cultural events like movie screenings to allow us to be exposed to things like I'm Not Your Negro and Black Violin and, you know, other Black cultural events. We have the continued work of so many people in this community that are producing art and literature, or exposing us to literature, exposing us to news. And thank you for pulling up the date. So the Black-Owned Business Expo is happening Sunday the 25th from 3 to 5 p.m. at, what's that location?
At the Emmanuel Family Life Center at 631 South Richard Allen Court in Spokane.
There you go.
It's free and open to the public. So nice to have a computer right next to us.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I see Black people in Spokane doing a lot of awesome things. And I see also a population that's coming out of its head down posture. I definitely have felt growing up here that there is a side of being Black in the Pacific Northwest that tells you to keep your head down, stay out of trouble, be excellent, but only the kind of excellent that gets you white accolades. So academic excellence, excellence within the systems of power that already exist, excellence in the way that you speak and dress, so long as the way that you speak and dress is adhering to the dominant culture, you know.
Athletic
excellence, that's always open to us. Entertainment excellence, that's always open to us. But I see us pulling our heads up, and I walk down the street and I see more Black people nodding to each other. Like, I nod at other Black people I see on the street and they nod back, and vice versa. And that's new. And that's honestly kind of powerful.
Yeah, that's right. I want to talk about a couple more specific people that we can highlight. I like the local list, though. That's a good local list. I could add to it. So I want to do that in just a second. All right. So on the topic of local things and also people should know about, you just reminded me, the Kimberly Crenshaw is coming. Do you want to explain who Kimberly Crenshaw is for those who don't know?
So Kimberly Crenshaw is the woman who coined the phrase intersectionality. And she is a Black woman and originally coined the term to really talk about how race, sex, and class all interact. The term has since been expanded in many ways since. But if you really want to kind of hear the initial concept from the person who coined the term and really understand what we mean when we use that word, she is actually coming to Gonzaga at the end of this month.
She's going to be here Thursday, February 28th from 7 to 8 at Gonzaga in the Hemmingson Center Ballroom. It's currently, the tickets are free, but you do have to reserve them. They're currently all gone, but you can get on a waiting list. I'm on the waiting list, crossing my fingers that I can go. So, but if not, yeah, she's a really good person to read about if you haven't.
And also, if you aren't able to make it to that event, she is on Twitter, at Sandy Locks. That's at SandyLocks, and I follow her.
Is she amazing on Twitter?
She's not like dropping fire like Ocasio-Cortez amazing, but she is deeply insightful. Yeah. Like, she's exactly what you would hope for from a person who coins a major sociological term. So yeah. I'm a fan.
Nice. More quietly there. And speaking of people who are amazing on Twitter and who are coming to Spokane, for folks who don't know, I think another person that people should definitely know as an academic and an artist and a writer and a powerful Black voice that you should know, way to go Get Lit in Spokane, because Roxane Gay is headlining Get Lit this year, which really freaked out when I figured that out. Those tickets will probably sell out, and they go on sale today, Monday, February 18th. So her writing's really important. Talking about intersectionality, I mean, she writes about the intersection of, you know, in her own life and for others, like gender, ability, race, etc., in really amazing ways. So I'm excited.
Two local events, two people who are a huge part of our Black present, and people who are not MLK or Rosa Parks for you to learn about.
Yep. much respect to both of them, but, you know, let's, yeah, expand it out. One person that I read up on more for this show, because I thought it was nice that it's President's Day, and I realized I don't know nearly enough about her as I should, is Shirley Chisholm.
Ah, yes.
I also thought I would, you know, surprise you by choosing someone kind of establishment in a way who was engaging with the formal electoral process in the biggest way possible, running for president. I did not realize that. So she was, I didn't realize she was the first Black woman in Congress in 1968 when she was elected.
I did not realize that either.
Yeah.
Like, I knew she was baller, but wow. Yeah.
So she got elected to Congress in 1968 and 4 years later ran for president. And she was both the first woman to run for president and the first African-American to run for president.
Okay, now, she was the first Black woman in Congress, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, specifically Black woman. I was like, yes, we had a bunch of Black people in Congress.
No, first,
right, yeah, after Reconstruction.
And, yeah.
Okay, baller, so, absolutely baller. I love,
and it's funny now because so many people are having this conversation about all of these new faces in the House and how, like, maybe they should calm down and they just got in the door. Like, why do they want to do all these things already? Talking about Ilhan Omar and, and AOC and all these other people. And so it's really funny to picture 1968,
oof,
Shirley Chisholm comes into Congress, and then in 1972, she's like, and by the way, you guys don't have your act together, so I'm running for president. Like, you don't have anyone compelling ready yet, so here I am.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Of course.
I actually have a Shirley Chisholm quote as part of my email signature. For my personal email, it's, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair.
Mm.
I absolutely adore it. And so I just, as I mentioned that, it's one of my favorite quotes. Of-
yeah. Well, and that's totally what she did. Yeah. And she also, and I also love that her campaign slogan was unbought and unbossed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason I can get behind her. So
I'm pumping my fist over here.
Yeah. And it's just so interesting. She was able to, you know, before the term intersectionality is coined, she was really able to capture a lot of those things. She almost flipped it in her announcement speech. She gives a speech and she says, like, while I am, like, Black and proud, I'm not the candidate of Black people. And, like, while I'm a woman and I'm, like, equally as proud of that, I'm not the women's movement candidate. Like, I'm this and I'm that, but, like, I'm trying to do this for, like, all the constituencies that I represent and everyone, which was pretty rad at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
People were really caught up in,
I was saying, she was saying, you know, you can't pigeonhole me and say that I somehow only represent this group that, you know, you're not a part of or whatever. Or that I only represent the groups that I'm a part of. I'm here for everybody and I'm proud of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she, and also this is a really good quote from her autobiography that I'll share. She said that I am a national figure because I was the first person in 192 years to be at once a congressman, Black, and a woman proves, I would think, that our society is not yet either just or free.
Hmm. Heyo.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, she's great. I want to share, I'll include in the show notes a video of her announcement speech because it's too long to play right now, but it's great. I think it's a good reminder of history when we're at this point where all of these things that appear to be very new are happening, but some of them have had predecessors in the past. So yeah.
Cool.
What about you? Who's on your list? Top five people we should know about.
Ooh. So probably my favorite Black hero for the years and years now is Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton, the chair of the Black Panther Party in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, oh my God, so he was 21 when he was chairman, Fred, and he did amazing things for his community. A lot of people, when I was growing up, I didn't know much about the Black Panthers. They never came up in history. Like, they were literally erased from my history books and my history curriculum for the most part growing up. I had a vague idea about these sort of militant people with afros and berets and guns marching about, you know, scaring the good, proper white people. And sort of had in my mind that, you know, oh, well, that's some sort of extreme thing that maybe I want to distance myself from, which is amazing when I consider there's a wonderful history between the intersection of the way that the Black Panther Party and guns rights activists in the NRA interacted. It is amazing. And you should read up on that interaction. Much of what we understand about the NRA now is a direct response to the existence of the Black Panthers. But anyway, also reason 27 why they will never be here for the rights of all Americans to own guns. Anyway, but I'm gonna get you in trouble, Taylor.
That's fine. You can talk about the NRA all you want.
But back to Chairman Fred. So he was the chairman of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, and that meant that he was a part of what people don't recognize was actually a mutual aid organization for the Black community. You know, I mean, think about it. The Black community for most of American history has not been able to make use of the same safety nets that white people have been able to, both public and private, right? So the private safety nets that many white people have been able to avail themselves of, such as their churches and the amount of money that was flowing through those churches, such as, you know, their family networks, and the way that it's not uncommon for someone to say, you know, I got a few $100 from my mom or my dad or whomever, or, you know, back then I got $50 from my, you know, mom or dad or whomever. Those private safety nets were different, had to be different because of our reduced socioeconomic status in this country as a direct result of slavery and Jim Crow and other policies that sought to prevent us from building equity in this nation. But on top of that, a lot of the public institutions that are supposed to be there for everyone were not only not helping Black people, but were founded on the basis of oppressing Black people. You know, people don't necessarily realize that the history of police in this country, you know, we say the words protect and serve, but that whole notion that they protect and serve, firstly, I ask protect and serve who, but secondly, that came later. Police were in many ways an amalgam of different local militia groups that were formed to first enforce the fugitive slave law and then to help enforce the dispossessing of various minority people in the United States of their property and land, or to drive them out of a given area. In many ways, I'm rambling, but I'm just going to go with it for a minute.
Yeah, go for it.
In many ways, while the federal government had used its military forces to continue enforcing the dispossession of natives of their land and whatnot, smaller towns and smaller municipalities began developing their own forces to handle their quote-unquote native problem, their Negro problem, their, you know, insert undesirable group here. And that is the bedrock upon which the American police force was built. So these institutions who are not going to help Black people in this nation protect themselves, not going to help them protect their property, that were established, in fact, do the opposite, that are not going to help them. Other institutions like our various housing laws, you know, how many of our Black vets came home from World War II and weren't able to make use of the GI Bill? How many people were shut out by redlining? How many people were shut out by every safety net that's ever been conceived of in this country has in some way been inflected by racism to keep the benefits of public safety nets and public programs and the ability to build up private equity and private security in the hands of white people. So all of that said, along comes the Black Panther Party. And they're here saying, look, you're not here for me. We're going to be here for ourselves. And they develop things like after-school programs to help keep kids out of trouble and help give them a place to go while their parents were at work, working jobs of hours that were not 9-to-5. All right? They developed school breakfast programs, you know, to help.
The first school breakfast program.
The first school breakfast program.
That was not an existent federal program.
That was created
anywhere before the Black Panthers did it.
No, that's so important.
Yeah.
Like, they pioneered in the areas of mutual aid and of assistance and in actually child and family care. They set up, like, if I'm not mistaken, like health collectives that were essentially the equivalent of Black health insurance, right? So they were here putting together infrastructure for the community that did not exist for them and would not exist for them. And because of that, they were criticized as, you know, being dangerous and communist and all this other stuff because they dared to take care of themselves. And Fred Hampton, as the leader of the party in Chicago, was a target of the FBI and of COINTELPRO efforts, COINTELPRO being a counterintelligence program. and a much ironed suspicion by local law enforcement. Because, yes, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense did have firearms that they brandished with all the confidence of any other NRA member in the United States that we see here today, with the intent of using them as tools to be there for themselves because they were living in a nation where the government would come for them, and it did. When Fred Hampton was 21 years old, at, I believe it was like 3 a.m., sleeping in bed next to his pregnant girlfriend, the FBI, in collusion with the local police force, busted in his apartment and fired, I believe it was 98 shots into the room and killed him.
While he was asleep.
While he was asleep. For the crime of leading people towards self-sufficiency. So, yeah, he's my hero. And he was killed for doing what I hope we never stop trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the Black Panthers, the history, and their... I think the one of the best, maybe the best, I don't know, it's so hard to say, but like if you look at examples of organizing in this country, like
They're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant.
I mean, yeah. There's a reason that the FBI had to go and break it up, and honestly, like, broke it up by assassinating and imprisoning the majority of the leadership.
Yep.
So yeah. That's something to remember. Yeah.
But I want to make sure that the last thing we remember isn't just that this dude was killed. Too often, too many of our heroes, too many of our leaders have been killed and imprisoned. Men, women, and queer folks in the Black community who strove to make progress. And we focus on their murders, and then we make them martyrs. And we shouldn't be doing that. Like, honestly, the fact that, Fred Hampton, that Martin Luther King, that, you know, all these various people were murdered by police or murdered by, you know, the power structures, is not the most notable thing about them. What were they doing that got them killed? What can we learn about the models of mutual aid and organizing and community support and you know, just radical self-empowerment? What can we learn about those things from them? That's what we need to be focusing on.
Yeah, for sure. Well, cool. I think we're out of time, believe it or not. But thanks so much for coming on with me.
Thanks for having
me. Talking. Yeah.
Letting me rant.
Yeah, please. For allowing me to hear you rant. So if you're just joining us at the end of the show and you want to hear any of the beginning of the show, you can find the podcast link at kyrs.org by going to programs and finding Praxis. You can also go directly to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, etc. by looking up Praxis. You can also go directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. You can always email me and reach out with questions and show suggestions and the rest at praxis@kyrs.org. So thanks for listening. Thanks for being with me, Jack.
Thank you.
And yeah, see you next time. I was a freedom fighter and she thought I sad.